I dressed, got into the car, and placed my egg with the utmost care on the dash. Then I eased myself gingerly onto the seat, because that hosing had sent a pint or two of dirty water down into my underpants, and sitting down was intensely uncomfortable. As I drove away, the darkness was thinning into the grey beginning of a new day, and around me the white bulk of the fells began to lift from the half-light, massive, smooth, and inexpressibly cold. I looked at the egg rocking gently on the dash and smiled to myself. I could still see Mr. Blackburn's sudden grin, still feel his punch on the chest, and my main sensation was of reassurance. Systems may be changing, but cows and calves and Yorkshire farmers were just the same. Chapter 37. On my wage of 7 and threepence a day, out of which was deducted maintenance for wife and child, I was unable to indulge in high living, even if I wanted to. But one evening in Windsor I decided to allow myself the luxury of one glass of beer. And as I pushed open the pub doorway, the first thing I saw was a man sitting at the corner of the bar with a small dog under his chair. Little things like that could lift me effortlessly back to my old life, and I could almost hear George Wilkes, the auctioneer in the Drover's Arms at Derby. "I reckon that's the best pub terrier I've ever seen." He bent down from the bar counter and patted Theo's shaggy head as it protruded from beneath his master's stool. It struck me that pub terrier wasn't a bad description. Theo was small and mainly white, though there were odd streaks of black on his flanks, and his muzzle had a bushy outgrowth of hair which made him undeniably attractive, but still more mysterious. I warmed to a Scottish colleague recently who, when pressed by a lady client to diagnose her dog's breed and lineage, replied finally, "Madam, I think it would be best just to call him a wee broon dug." By the same token, Theo could be safely described as a wee white dug, but in Yorkshire the expression pub terrier would be more easily understood. His master, Paul Cotterill, looked down from his high perch. "What's he saying about you, old chap?" he murmured languidly, and at the sound of his voice the little animal leapt, eager and wagging, from his retreat. Theo spent a considerable part of his life between the four metal legs of that stool, as did his master on the seat, and it often seemed to me to be a waste of time for both of them. I often took my own dog, Sam, into pubs, and he could squat beneath my seat, but whereas it was an occasional thing with me, maybe once or twice a week, with Paul Cotterill it was an unvarying ritual. Every night, from 8 o'clock onwards, he could be found sitting there at the end of the bar of the Drover's Arms, pint glass in front of him, little curly pipe drooping over his chin. For a young man like him, he was a bachelor in his late 30s, and a person of education and intelligence, it seemed a sterile existence. He turned to me as I approached the counter. "Hello, Jim. Let me get you a drink." "That's very kind of you, Paul," I replied. "I'll have a pint." "Splendid." He turned to the barmaid with easy courtesy. "Could I trouble you, Moira?" We sipped our beer and we chatted. This time it was about the music festival at Broughton, and then we got on to music in general. As with any other topic I discussed with him, he seemed to know a lot about it. "So you're not all that keen on Bach?" he inquired lazily. "No, not really. Some of it, yes, but on the whole I like something a bit more emotional. Elgar, Beethoven, Mozart, even Tchaikovsky. I suppose you highbrows look down your noses at him." He shrugged, puffed his little pipe, and regarded me with a half-smile, one eyebrow raised. He often looked like that, and it made me feel he ought to wear a monocle. But he didn't enthuse about Bach, though it seemed he was his favourite composer. He never enthused about anything, and he listened with that funny look on his face while I rhapsodied about the Elgar Violin Concerto.